Welcome back to Logical with Ludmila, where we untangle the legal knots so that you don't have to. I'm Ludmila Yamalova, a U.S. qualified lawyer based in Dubai. In each episode, we break down complex law into clear, practical insights that you can actually use. In today's episode, we'll be covering crypto scams in the UAE and what you can realistically do about them. Recently, we have seen a surge of clients who are victims of crypto fraud, classical investment scams dressed up with modern tools. At a high level, they can be described as follows: Signal / WhatsApp / Telegram trading groups touting as guaranteed daily returns, or fake exchanges or invite-only platforms that allow small early withdrawals, then lock accounts and demand more fees. Or romance / relationship approaches turning into mentorship in crypto with money routed across multiple wallets. Also, impersonation of licensed firms or regulators leaning on the UAE's strong regulatory brands such as ESCA, VARA, and DFSA to look legitimate, as well as remote access malware and fake consumer protection sites that hijack devices and banking apps, something that Dubai Police has warned about repeatedly. So what triggered also this particular episode is the few clients, recent clients have come to us exactly about these type of crypto scams that I've just outlined. So one client, for example, in the interest of privacy, I'll use fictitious names. But one client, let's call him Marat, he joined a WhatsApp group discussing markets. So it's like a WhatsApp discussion group. And it pivoted on new coin trading on a platform accessible only by invitation code from somebody named Claudia Becker. And early trades paid off, so obviously built confidence. While traveling, an order so-called failed due to unusual IP activity. And then the support said the account was locked because of this unusual IP activity. And it ultimately demanded an additional about $290,000 or $300,000 to unlock the account. So all in all, the total losses were about equivalent of US $1.1 million in USDT sent from a Binance wallet to the platform with transfers originated between Egypt and Dubai. So names like Claudia Becker and Professor Adrian Bauer could not be verified, which were the sort of names on this WhatsApp discussion group. And obviously identities were likely fabricated. So I can talk a little more about just some of it. It came out as we were going through the process, but you know, the names of the Claudia Becker and the Professor Adrian Bauer, these are sort of names in this WhatsApp group that ultimately by perhaps you the way the name sounded and the phrases used like professor or the words used in the phrases gave some sort of level of legitimacy to this discussion, this the WhatsApp group, and therefore ultimately incentivized clients to to open up their wallet. Another case also involved a German client who met the sort of self-styled crypto boss at a gym in Qatar and who was touting as having had a very successful crypto investment platform. And in this particular case, the client was fairly sophisticated or kind of a successful business person. So, in fact, demanded a contract and drafted a contract on the basis of which we basically decided to agree to invest in this kind of crypto platform that was supposedly run by this supposed crypto boss. And you know, the contract was drafted, so at least there's something, but it was not a very thorough one. It was not a very legible contract or not a very helpful contract to rely on for tracing purposes. But certainly at least there was some kind of level of due diligence, if you will, and some sort of effort put in before parting with his crypto. And so as part of this, once the contract was executed, as part of this transaction, the client had transferred a few, made a few transfers, and the small these small tests, they worked. And even with modest withdrawals, all that worked. And then they came, obviously, larger transfers. And once the larger transfers started hitting the accounts to ever-changing wallets as well, then all of a sudden the return stopped. And then excuses followed. And then communications kind of went dark. So these are some specific examples that recently have come to us. And, you know, it, from a legal standpoint, us as lawyers, what we look for, because whenever a client comes to us, they come with a problem, obviously every problem, before you're able to provide some kind of advice or roadmap, you need to look at the underlying documents. Now, documents don't necessarily need to be something formal, like a document that's a 50-page contract, but it has to be a document some kind of documents that we need to be able to rely on. Some of the challenges that we see in these kinds of crypto scams usually is just the counterparty reality check. So often there are like no proper documents, or no verifiable like ID or passports, sometimes not even a basic sort of contract. And that's an example I said earlier where you had these names, Claudia Becker and Professor Adrian Bauer. But who are these? These are just names. There are no actual documents supporting that person. But then Claudia, for example, Becker existed, or the professor existed, and he was even the professor. So there is, most cases, there are no passport copies. There is no kind of any other verifiable IDs and no other sort of documents. And even when you do have contracts, like I mentioned earlier, they're so so basic, if you even call it that, and they're so vague that they're ultimately kind of more or less useless for tracing purposes. And so that's one set of problems, right? It's due diligence or lack thereof. There are just no documents. And second one is the payment trail. Very difficult to trace payment trail in the traditional sense, because with banks, obviously, we can trace via SWIFT, IBAN, or copies of the checks. I mean, whenever these kind of transfers happen, it's very easy to do just basic request, a bank statement from the bank, and use that to prove that at least the transfer went out and who it went to. Similarly, when you write a check, you have a copy of the check, very clear to clearly identify the amount and also where the money went. With crypto, all you see is addresses and hashes on chain, but no specific identities. So that's the other sort of set of problems that from sort of a legal standpoint that we face with crypto scams in particular as compared to traditional financial scams. Then third is just the communication channels. I guess by virtue of the specific asset or a crypto or virtual asset being crypto, the people that use it tend to kind of to rely more on the modern means of communication, which are WhatsApp, Telegrams, and Signal, and other kind of social media accounts or tools. That in itself means that all you have is a phone number. Now, that phone number may or may not belong to the name that is sort of registered or looks like it belongs to. That's if you're using WhatsApp for Telegram, as a lot of Telegram users would know. Often there is a way to have a Telegram account that it does not have a number. It just has a name. So you don't even really know for jurisdictional purposes, specifically if that person that you have been handling with or dealing with is even based in the UAE, right? All you have is their Telegram name. So for the purposes of being able to take this to the authorities, very difficult to know whether that specific Telegram number, without the proper sort of more detailed due diligence, whether that particular Telegram number or person actually is even under the UAE jurisdiction. And then often also the profile photos are kind of like stock images as well. So that's kind of the third category of issues that we face as lawyers with crypto scams. And the fourth one is the jurisdiction, and that kind of where it all comes down to, and that's where that's also been the issue for us in these specific examples that I just mentioned earlier. So in most cases, the numbers and the servers are often not UAE based. And if the people, assets, or platforms lack a UAE nexus, the onshore jurisdiction becomes much tougher. So, for example, in the first example I mentioned, of a client. There, when we went into this WhatsApp group and we went to this Claudia Becker and Professor Adrian Bauer WhatsApp messages, if you actually open up, one was, I think, in Spain, the other one was in Portugal. So I have no relation to the UAE, although the client has been was based in the UAE and all along was under belief that all of this was happening within the UAE. And then in the other example of the German client, so same sort of thing, the phone number that was registered to this WhatsApp contact, and there was also a group of people that they were talking to with, they were kind of Gulf numbers from the Gulf, but not in the UAE. So for jurisdiction purposes, we didn't even know how to identify. So yes, the client perhaps could be based in the UAE. So jurisdiction-wise, the client has the ability to file a case in the UAE, but ultimately it only makes sense to file a case in the UAE against the perpetrator if you know that you have some sort of leverage or enforcement mechanism against the perpetrator in the UAE. But if that person is in Portugal or Spain, I mean, first of all, in practical terms, it's difficult to file a case against them. But then ultimately, I guess in legal terms, it's difficult. But in practical terms, even if you have a judgment at the end, how are you going to be enforcing against somebody who is not based in the UAE? So a lot more challenging. In terms of the legal framework, at the outset, it's important to highlight that although this is not really the purpose of this specific topic, and I've covered this before, but in the UAE, crypto activity is legal only when licensed by the correct authority. And depending on what type of business you have and where you're based, you have either ESCA or VARA or DFSA or DIFC and so on and so forth. So anything else is a red flag. Now, just kind of very high level, again, this is not the purpose of today's discussion because I dedicated a specific, very detailed, perhaps a little too technical episode on all the legislative framework that applies to virtual assets and licensing in the UAE. But at a high level, just kind of as a reminder that at the federal level, there's specific laws, for example, that any kind of businesses that are based in the UAE, they deal with virtual assets nationwide outside of financial free zones. So they have to be licensed by the Securities and Commodities Authority or ESCA and various local authorities. And there's various licensing regulations. And otherwise, as per this regulation, which is, by the way, the cabinet resolution number 111 of 2022 that regulates virtual assets, it basically prohibits any unlicensed activity. And then also the ESCA guidelines from 2024 further details obligations of all these virtual assets providers and market conduct. Once again, basically in short, stating that anybody who doesn't have this kind of a license that operates at the national level is basically operating illegally. In Dubai, outside of the DFC, we have VARA, the Virtual Regulatory Agency, and it has its own regulations. So there's a Dubai Law Number 4 from 2022, plus the VARA Regulations Rulebooks from 2023 that sets very specific licensing requirements, activity permissions, and AML and CFT and market abuse prohibitions. You know, but if a service is offered in or from Dubai, it generally needs a VARA authorization. Again, within Dubai, but within the DIFC free zone, there is DFSA plus DIFC law. And the DFSA has its own specific crypto token regime, which regulates crypto services within the DIFC. The DFC digital assets law as well from 2024 codifies concepts of digital assets as property, control, and transfers and remedies, which is crucial for recovery litigation. So all that means is that in the UAE, in the virtual asset world, there are very specific regulations that must be followed for anybody to be engaged in any kind of virtual asset activities. And again, I don't want to reiterate the previous episode that I covered on the regulations and the requirements. But in short, any kind of those examples that I mentioned before about this, the crypto investments acting as custodians for crypto exchanges. I mean, any one of these activities, in short, will fall under the kind of the UAE's in simple terms, a virtual asset or a regulation framework, which means, in short, the companies require licenses. So therefore, if you are trying to get into some kind of an investment deal with an entity or an individual, it first of all should not be an individual, because an individual needs to be licensed. And if it is a legal entity, then you need to make sure that that legal entity is licensed as per these regulations I just kind of briefly outlined. And anybody that is not licensed properly, therefore, should be a red flag for you, because that means that as far as the UAE is concerned, they are not legally providing or providing these kinds of services, and they're not legally operating. And therefore, with regards to enforcement of your rights, ultimately, you know, the sort of the you are facing upstream battle, because you should have known better than to have gotten involved with these kinds of investment schemes that are not properly licensed. And this is exactly why, by the way, these licensing requirements, these such stringent licensing requirements exist, is just to protect investors for these, exactly against these very scams. So in terms of the kind of the immediate practical steps, what, you know, if you have been scammed, if you think that you have been scammed, you know, what can you do? So, you know, the first one is just document everything, right? And so save the transactions, hashes and addresses right away. Also take screenshots of the platform, the chat logs, any kind of invites, the KYCs, the timestamps, and any kind of domain or URL. So just capture whatever it is, you know, document. So that's, you know, that's one, document everything and collect the documents and save it. The other one is try to trace funds. Now, tracing funds is a lot more difficult. And I have to tell you, I'll tell you a little secret I had to myself to learn quite a bit about what sort of mechanisms or tools exist for tracing of virtual asset funds. Now, we know how to trace those funds if, again, as mentioned earlier, these are done through traditional banking means or writing out checks and even doing cash transfers. Usually there's some sort of documentation that shows that some kind of cash went out, some money changed hands. Now, with anything to do with virtual assets, a lot more difficult. So, but there are, as I have learned, there's these two sort of different service providers, categories of service providers that could help. And ultimately, all those who have found themselves, or I guess who deal with crypto, need to be aware of, because they may need to avail their services sooner or later. So one is called the Blockchain Explorers, and that's basically, these are public search engines for blockchain transactions. So, and it lets anyone see what happened on the blockchain, when, between which wallet addresses, and for how much, all in real time. So, and every major blockchain has its own explorer maintained by independent companies or foundations. So they don't store your funds or execute trades. They simply make blockchain data transparent and searchable. And then in terms of how it works, so you enter a wallet address, a transaction hash, or a block number, and then the Explorer retrieves all related records, amounts, the timestamps, the sending and receiving addresses, and current confirmation status. So think of it as a kind of blockchain public ledger viewer. There are no passwords, no permissions, just transparency. Now in terms of what you can and cannot see through these explorers, is what's visible is basically the wallet addresses, the transaction hash, as I said, the amounts transfers, tokens involved, block confirmation details, and basic links between wallets. What is not visible is the real identities behind the wallet addresses, and off-chain communications or agreements, and the private keys or passwords. So that's why blockchain forensic firms become crucial. Now, they connect on-chain transparency with off-chain identity tracing. So these professional forensics, and they're basically public blockchain. Public blockchain explorers show what happened, while blockchain forensics show who did it and where the money went. So it's a different level of, obviously, involvement, a different level of transparency, and therefore different level of documentation ultimately. So professional forensics, I mean, some of the companies that we sort of come across is Chain Analysis, Elliptic, and TRM Labs. So these are the ones that keep coming up as the blockchain forensic. And these, by the way, their reports are what courts, police, and other exchanges actually act on. So when you see wallet addresses and transaction hashes on Etherscan or Trailscan, you're looking at raw public data and numbers without names. Forensic investigators step in to connect those numbers to real-world actors, exchanges, and eventually legal accountability. So let's kind of go because this is the reason I took the time to kind of to research myself and understand this, because from a legal standpoint, as I mentioned earlier, without the documentation, there's very little that we can do, right? So before you're able to refer anything to the court, to the police, and any other, to any other authority, you need to have documentation. But since documentation in this virtual world is so scant, then so this is why you really need to ultimately be able to, if you want to ever recover anything, you will need to retain services of these providers. And to that end, these blockchain forensic service providers is basically something that we all need to be aware of, because more and more they will be of critical importance to all those who deal with virtual assets. So I guess without their help, we as legal practitioners are also very limited in our ability to help. So as I mentioned earlier, kind of in more detail, so blockchain forensics, what they do is that they trace the flow of funds. So they follow every hop the stolen crypto takes across wallets, blockchains, and exchanges. And they use very sophisticated software maps and map out the entire network of addresses, revealing patterns, mixers, or bridges used to conceal funds. They also identify exchange touch points. So when crypto hits a centralized exchange like Binance, Coinbase, or Kraken, it often becomes a traceable to verified accounts, or KYCs. So then forensic teams can identify those points so that then lawyers can request disclosure or freezing orders through regulators or courts. Also, they can produce generate evidentiary reports. So these reports visually map wallet activity and asset movement. And these reports are admissible in court and are often required by police or regulator filings before you can do anything regarding trying to chase down your money. And so, for example, in Dubai, the Dubai Police Cybercrime Division and the DFC courts have already used such reports in major cases. So this is why it's really important to know that these are the options, I guess, that exist, but also in some ways, in most ways, they are mandatory, obligatory for you to exercise if you ever want to try to be able to recoup your losses. So once you've received, once you've gotten all these documents, then you have some kind of evidence to rely on. So then you need to, depending on what happened and sort of what you're trying to do and who you're chasing. So one thing you need to do is to file a Dubai police complaint, which, you know, could be done e-crime, the online portal, and register like a cyber fraud report. And obviously this will apply in cases where the perpetrator, right, the scammer, has some kind of connection to the UAE. So you'll be filing a case against an individual in the UAE with the Dubai police. Also, for example, if you got scammed through some sort of a platform because it pretended to be licensed, then you need to notify the regulator. And depending on, as I mentioned earlier, depending on where this platform was alleging to be, you would, for example, if it looked like it was supposedly a VARA platform, regulated platform, then you would report it with VARA. If it's in the DIFC, it would be the DFSA, and so on and so forth. Now, recently, this is why I wanted to include, this is basically, I literally just stumbled upon this a few days ago. There's a new service in the UAE. It's called AMEN. I'm not sure how to pronounce it correctly. It's spelled AMEN and .AE. And it's basically a digital platform that's developed to enhance the role of the community in monitoring the media content circulated within the country, the UAE, that is. And so it empowers individuals and, you know, I guess in many cases, victims, to report non-compliant content and actively participate in establishing a safe and responsible media environment. That basically ultimately reflects society's awareness and positive engagement with what is published in the digital space. So that's sort of the objective of this specific service, of this platform. And it has three different categories of content that you can report. One is called under the sort of category of misleading content. That's one. The second one is under unsafe content. And third is under advertisement content. So this particular service in the context of this discussion would be helpful if, let's say, you were scammed by some kind of some platform that holds itself out to be VARA licensed or DFSA licensed, and it was on the back of that that you kind of entrusted your crypto wallet or crypto payments to them. So that's basically a platform that you would definitely then report under one of these categories. It could be misleading content, it could be unsafe content, or it could be advertisement content. So this is basically, it's for individuals, for the community to help regulate and monitor all this kind of public or online communications, online content. So how it gets sort of transferred from there, but I guess the idea is like if you report, for example, a platform that holds itself out to be a VARA license, but it isn't. So once you report it through this service, the presumption is that then the authorities, because it is a government site, authorities in the UAE will be able to shut down or at least temporarily freeze that specific platform. So I think that's it's a brand new service that at least I learned about recently, and we're as a team studying it right now. But I think it's pretty cool because, for example, slightly digressing, we had recently a few clients who have come to us because they were, they were represented, for example, that you can get a golden visa in the UAE, and they met somebody at a crypto event, and this person has a very active crypto YouTube channel, and on this YouTube channel, he describes how it's basically in the UAE you can get a golden visa if you pay 10,000 dirhams, and you'll have a 10-year golden visa. And so my client said, well, yeah, obviously, I paid $20,000. To this crypto enthusiast who has this extremely, according to my client, extremely active crypto YouTube channel that that's advertising this sort of this kind of service. Now that service is clearly misinformation because the UAE government does not have a golden visa or just anybody. There's very specific regulations that will allow somebody to apply for golden visa and pass, and it certainly is not what 10,000 dirhams for sure. So now this person, I went back and I listened to his YouTube channel, and sure enough, all that. So that's basically misleading advertisement. So there's an interesting example of how that particular YouTube channel and perhaps the website could be reported to the UAE through this Aman service, and then the authorities in the UAE presumably would be able to at least freeze it, and that would be in their interest because something like I just described, where this YouTuber is talking about how the UAE government is issuing these visas and how you can guarantee these visas on the back of a payment of $20,000, for example, that's clearly misrepresenting the UAE government's policies and services and laws. Therefore is dangerous and in the not in the interest kind of for the UAE safety and security. So I can see how the authorities in that particular case, if you report this, would get involved kind of quickly and would be able to at least temporarily suspend those channels of social media portals until further investigation. And then, depending on the amount, the final kind of remedy that could be considered is that depending on the amount involved, you could also consider Interpol channels through the UAE authorities kind of for large cross-border frauds. So now practical tips for reporting is obviously to act quickly. Because the sooner you report, the better chances of freezing assets or tracing funds. So don't wait. Don't think, oh my God, I'm so embarrassed. I should not have fallen for it. Let me see if I can figure it out myself and fix it. And certainly don't try to throw more money to try to recover What you already invested. So it's kind of truly throwing bad money after good. So act fast and then capture all the evidence, includes all the transaction details, wallet addresses, and kind of keep track of all that data along the way. Keep screenshots, chat logs, any identification you have of the scam platform. You keep communications. You usually receive a reference number or record recorded and sort of follow it up. Use the right channel for your emirate. For example, if you wanted to record, like it's in Dubai, it's Al Amin services for Dubai. Other emirates have the equivalent services in Abu Dhabi, Amman service for kind of anonymous reporting. So if you want to report. And then otherwise, if your funds touched a centralized exchange like Binance or Kraken, then act fast to seek freezes via police or urgent court orders. So these exchanges will, in fact, act for you. But in order to act, they will need to have those documents I referenced earlier. So through the forensics, the blockchain forensics. So definitely try to kind of to if you have the ability, hire the right services. You should be able to get your documents. And with those documents, you'll have to act very quickly. Freeze, at least you'll be able to get like a kind of an urgent court order that will allow you at least to kind of get the ball rolling. So with regards to specific legal routes, I mean, there's different. There's the courts. We talked about the courts and we talked about the criminal aspect. So criminal, I mean, that's really just ultimately will not bring money back to you, right? Criminal, the criminal law is designed to basically prosecute the perpetrator and punish them. So it's the state that's punishing them. And so therefore, the remedy to you is basically just a satisfaction the person was caught and put behind bars, for example. But you will not be able to get your money back. So whenever you have found yourself as a victim of scam, remember that, yes, if you can report the person to the local authorities here, i.e. the police, and through the cybercrime channels, yes, do that. But you can only do that if the person is within the UAE. But you should always know that in parallel, if you ever want to get your money back, you will need to file a civil case to try to recover the money. Now, anything to do with sort of crypto assets or in virtual assets and scams, it's such a novel subject still for a lot of people. And so the local courts as well are learning more about them, but they are harder to litigate because A, it's a new subject. B, as I mentioned earlier, there's just very little documents. And then C, obviously being able to kind of to explain the complexity of all this very technical field in a language, because it all, you'll have to explain it in Arabic. Most of the stuff happens in English. So there's different complexity in arguing these kinds of matters in the local courts. Now, the DIFC, the DIFC courts in Dubai, has a subset court, which is called the Digital Economy Court. And so Digital Economy Court is sort of designed exactly to handle, among other things, like crypto disputes. And it has, by the way, already sort of handled multimillion-dollar crypto disputes. And as part of these disputes, courts have recognized crypto clearly as property. And then also navigated the custody/control issues. And one case of note, and I'll talk about this a little more shortly, it's a Huabi and Tabarak case. And that's kind of one of the biggest cases that perhaps one of the main cases the DIFC Digital Economy Court has been handling and has been in the headlines. But there's an example of A, how there's a specific sort of a dedicated court that is sort of plans and whose objective is to deal exactly with these technical matters, disputes, and two, that it is capable of understanding these disputes and also being able to sort of take measures to protect victims' interests. And among other things, the Digital Economy Court has remedies such as declaratory relief and disclosure against intermediaries and injunction. So these are very technical legal tools that perhaps for the time being the local courts may not have in the same way that this Digital Economy Court, which is, among other things, disclosure against intermediaries. And those who deal with virtual assets would know that the role of intermediaries, how important it is, and in most cases, they're not based in the UAE, so the local courts may have limited jurisdiction to reach to them and get their compliance and their disclosures from them. Now, the Digital Economy Court and the DFC has been able to do it and also issue injunctions, which again is sort of a power that for the time being seems to be more available to common law courts such as the DFC courts and not so much the local courts. So that's basically something just to kind of a space to watch. And if the amount is significant enough, that is basically the court that you would most likely want to avail yourself of, you know, in trying to pursue these matters. But there is obviously still a question of jurisdiction. So if you're entertaining any of these sort of virtual assets / crypto transactions, investments and such, and you should have an agreement on the basis of which you'll be functioning. And as part of this agreement, do consider including the DIFC jurisdiction as sort of governing jurisdiction for these kinds of disputes, because then it will open the door for you to be able to use the Digital Economy Court in the event, unfortunately, if you fall victim to one of these scams. And some of the kind of, I guess, the other reason behind using the digital court is that, as I mentioned earlier, they have the tools that they have are pretty powerful, and they have been recently used, such as like freezing orders. And these include worldwide freezing orders and Norwich-type disclosure orders to compel exchanges and payment providers to reveal KYC tied to wallet flows. And so the DFC practice shows that it's kind of increasing openness to robust interim relief to prevent dissipation of assets. And also because of the DFC sort of standing, it has more of an international enforcement standing or, I guess, ability. So DFC judgments often travel more easily due to common law framework. So therefore, once again, if you are in this space and you're in the UAE, or even if you're not in the UAE, you can contract into the DIFC courts. So do consider contracting into the DIFC courts and specifically the digital court, and subject yourself to those laws and that jurisdiction, because then you have better chances of being able to seek redress in the event something goes amiss. So kind of on that point, I wanted to share perhaps the more recent legal developments that may help victims. And that's, again, under the DFC, so Digital Asset Law, which was published only in 2024. And it confirms, among other things, so digital assets is property, and also clarifies control and transfer, and otherwise strengthens claims for proprietary remedies and injunctions. So, for example, the DFC Court of Appeal in Huabi and Tabarak case, which is 2024, confirmed that the property status of crypto and the relevance of control through private keys, which is a landmark case for recovery strategy and interim relief. So anyone who finds themselves in this unfortunate situation, definitely look up that specific case. And much of the court decisions are online, so easily accessible. So familiarize yourself if you're considering doing some taking legal measurements to try to recover or protect your interests. But also, even before you enter into a contract, it would suit you your interest to read these court judgments and include the relevant principles into the underlying contract before the problem occurs. And then there's the, as I mentioned before, the DFSA and the crypto token regime and the VAR rule books, which provide very clear pathways to identify who is licensed, who is not, which are useful platforms for to know who falsely claims to be authorized. And I've covered it in my other podcast, but it's a pretty publicly available platforms that will, where you can see on, let's say, on the VARA website to see which companies actually have been licensed by VARA. So if they don't appear on the VARA public registry, then that means they are not properly licensed. So there is your other kind of mechanism to vet to see if you're dealing with the sort of legitimate providers. So now let me kind of get into, this is a fairly new development, but perhaps we'll talk about crypto scams that may be helpful. It's a fairly powerful recent development in the UAE legal space that directly impacts victims of crypto scams and therefore kind of deserves its own mention. And the case is in brief. So it's a case called Tectorix LTD versus Aria Commodities DMCC and ORS. And so the case was filed in 2025 and handled in the DFC's Digital Economy Court. And as part of this case, there was an order issuing a worldwide freezing order. So worldwide freezing order, which is a big deal in legal terms, a very, very big deal to be able to apply and get this sort of freezing order. And it was issued over the assets up to $456 million. So it's a very big deal. It was a very big transaction, therefore obviously justified. This kind of legal expense and legal investment to try to obtain a worldwide freezing order. And so the DFC Digital Economy Court did issue this freezing order, and it was linked to misappropriating stablecoin reserves in the amount of about $450 million. And so the freezing order was granted because there was a serious issue to be tried. And the claimant alleged diversion of funds from stablecoin reserves into an offshore fund and then to Aria DMCC in Dubai. So that was kind of the trail. And there was a real risk of dissipation, the court held, including a proposed securitization of assets. And then, therefore, the court accepted disclosure orders under a penal notice or under penal notice to trace beneficiary details and fund flows. Big deal. Like, again, this is something very technical, and it is very technical from the technical side of things. It was also very technical from the legal side of things. So this is why this particular case deserves special mention. You know, and why it matters for crypto scam victims, because it confirms that, once again, the digital assets, such as crypto, stablecoins, are now treated as property. And therefore can be so subject to freezing orders and proprietary relief. And also that the Digital Economy Court showed it can issue freezing orders globally, not just in respect of onshore assets when justified. To slowly bring this discussion to closure, just a reminder, kind of realities to manage, right? So if funds sit in the cold wallet with no centralized exchange touch point and no KYC trail, a recovery is very unlikely. I mean, that's just the cold reality of a cold wallet. Then if assets hit centralized exchange, then you have a window. But the clock is brutal. So move within hours, if you know, just days, not weeks. So you do need to be on your toes and move very swiftly. And otherwise, expect cross-border hurdles. Identify spoofing VPNs, non-UAE SIM cards, and entities with no UAE nexus. So that's something to keep in mind. So always be on the lookout for who it is exactly you're dealing with. So it kind of brings me back to the very beginning that I started. You know, who are the parties, the counterparties you're dealing with? Have their details. And make sure that if you're dealing within the UAE, that they have some sort of nexus to the UAE, because otherwise you will not be able to pursue them within the UAE in practical terms. So the legal kind of legal takeaways, once again, crypto in the DIFC is considered property, and therefore you can assert ownership and misappropriation and seek proprietary relief, which is a very valuable and a very powerful legal tool, which otherwise might not be available kind of in the more traditional courts. And then control matters. You know, courts look at who controls the asset, who has keys, instruction power, not just nominal titles. And once again, documentation wins. Documentation, documentation, documentation. So make sure you have clear contracts, clear custody terms, escrow, and KYC drastically improve your outcome. And then remember, licensing is always the first filter. If a counterparty is not on the VAR, DFSA, or SK, ESCA radar, is treated as a non-compliant. And then just kind of buyer beware. In conclusion, if you remember one thing, speed plus evidence, the UAE has built a robust framework through VARA, ESCA, DFSA, and the DFC law and the cybercrime enforcement, but success hinges on fast action, forensics, and the right forum. That's all for this episode of Logica with Ludmila. If you found this episode useful and you like what we do, you can always find more on our website, that is lylawyers.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And for the full experience, you can watch us on video podcast on YouTube. Until next time, stay informed, stay safe, and keep things logical.